Today at Reader's Corner, Adam Gentleson, author of Kill Switch, The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Most major decisions coming out of Washington bear the stamp of the United States Senate, an institution controlled by people who are almost exclusively white, overwhelmingly male, and disproportionately conservative. Although it does not represent a majority of Americans and will not for the foreseeable future, today's Senate possesses the power to block most legislation. Once known as the world's greatest deliberative body, the Senate of today seems best known for its ability to frustrate and kill the efforts of the majority. How'd this happen? In his book, Kill Switch, The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy, former Senate insider Adam Gentleson contends that far from reflecting the framers' vision, the Senate has been transformed over the decades by a tenacious minority of white conservatives. Adam Gentleson is the executive director of Battleborne Collective and a former deputy chief of staff to Senator Harry Reid. A columnist for GQ and frequent political commentator on MSNBC, Kill Switch is Gentleson's first book. Adam Gentleson, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks. Thank you so much, Bob. It's great to be here.
Well, Adam, at the outset of your book, you say the Senate is in a steady state of decline. How so?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, when I say steady, I mean steady. It's been going on for a long time.
Sure.
You know, one could argue, as some historians do, that it's been in decline since the passage of the Golden Age in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s. But I think that what's really accelerated the decline in recent years is the rise of something that we've come to accept as normal, which is this idea that anything that passes requires 60 votes, or in other words, requires a supermajority threshold. This is something that we've come to accept as a normal part of our political landscape, but it's actually a relatively recent development. For most of its existence, for 200 plus years, almost every bill that came before the Senate passed or failed on a majority basis. The only exception were civil rights bills that I lay out in the book, where the supermajority threshold started to be applied to them exclusively in the Jim Crow era. But even during that era, every other bill that came before the Senate passed or failed on a majority vote basis. So what's happened is that the rise of the supermajority threshold for all issues has allowed a minority, and in the book I describe it as a super minority, given the discrepancy between their actual numbers and the amount of power that they wield. This supermajority threshold has allowed this minority to wield control over everything that passes into law in our government and to gridlock the Senate in order to make the majority look bad and try to get themselves from the minority back into the majority. So while the Senate has been in decline for a long time, it's really the rise of this supermajority threshold that I think has accelerated that in recent years and caused this massive paralyzing gridlock that has come to characterize the institution recently.
Well, let's have you share with our listeners the insider's look at the United States Senate. Somewhere in your book, I read where you talk about what the Senate really looks like behind the scenes. And it's a considerable contrast to what anyone would find walking into their state capitol, where they're going to find members in their seats and they're going to actually see and watch a debate in progress. Now take us to the U.S. Senate and the way it works, so to speak, or maybe we should say the way it doesn't work.
That's right. If you were to walk into the United States Senate on any given day, and members of the public can still do this, there's a observer's gallery ringing the floor in the upper levels where people can sit and observe the daily proceedings. On any given day, what you would see, or if you flip on C-SPAN 2, which tracks, you know, the proceedings of the Senate on a daily basis, what you would see, if you're lucky, is perhaps one or two senators on the floor. What they will probably be doing is giving a speech, and by that I mean reading off of a sheet of paper that their staff has prepared. It is very possible, and in fact quite likely, that the senator is seeing these words for the first time as they read off this sheet of paper. Nobody will be listening to them. The other people in the chamber will be maybe a few other senators, but mostly staff who are sort of milling about the floor, conducting daily business. So, you know, to the extent that this senator who's reading the speech is engaging in any form of debate, it's only debate in the most technical sense of the word, in the sense that they are making an argument. There's certainly no engagement. There's no exchange of ideas. There's no effort to really persuade anybody because nobody's listening. After they give this speech, the senator will simply walk away, maybe say hi and chat with some of the people they see on the floor. And then they'll go back to their office, where they'll proceed to spend the rest of the day having meetings with constituents, interest groups, and spending a lot of that time fundraising. Some studies have determined that senators spend most of their time fundraising. Some have shown even as much as 2/3 of their time is spent fundraising. So the idea that the Senate is this great forum for debate or platform for the exchange of ideas simply doesn't match up to the reality. Today, it is a paralyzed institution where there is no genuine exchange of ideas. If the scene that I just described is what you're going to find if you're lucky, chances are if you turn it on, you might find the Senate in what's called a quorum call, where nothing is happening on the floor. You will be able to see it on the C-SPAN screen. You'll be able to see staff milling about, but there'll be no business actually being conducted. And the Senate spends a great deal of time in these quorum calls. So, to the extent that we have this idea of the Senate as a forum for debate, that idea used to be true, at least to some extent, but today the reality simply doesn't match that idea at all.
And even if they were listening, I guess the next question is, how representative is the U.S. Senate today of Americans? I think at one point you say that the U.S. Senate is sorted as never before. What do you mean by that?
That's right. So there are two major dynamics governing the sort of representation of the Senate today. One is polarization. And, the Senate used to have a mixture of ideologies. Cross-partisan coalitions used to be very common. Senators used to sort of group themselves more by regional interests or issue-based interests than they did by party. Western senators, for instance, whether they were Republicans or Democrats, would all have common ground when it came to things like water rights, which were a huge issue and continue to be a huge issue. But an issue like that would cause people to put aside their partisan allegiances and come together around that issue-based interest. Today, senators group almost exclusively by party, and this tracks with the broader partisan sorting that we have in America. That partisan sorting tracks with the broader sorting that we see in our daily lives in many aspects beyond politics, where people group themselves by where they shop or what cars they drive or what TV shows they watch. So this is something that goes beyond politics, and that's why it's so powerful. In many ways, the Senate is sort of a lagging indicator, and it has taken longer to sort itself than many other aspects of American lives. As recently as 2008, when Obama was elected, you had a lot of Democratic senators who came from red states, which had voted against Obama, and you had a lot of Republican senators who came from blue states who had voted for Obama. Today, with very few exceptions, senators' party identification tracks with the presidential loyalty of their state. So red state senators, states that vote for Republicans in the presidential election, have Republican senators, and blue states have Democratic senators. So what that means is there's very little opportunity for cross-party cooperation, because every political incentive facing a senator pulls them towards party loyalty. If their state is backing the Republican presidential candidate, they have every political incentive to toe the party line, and very little incentive to cross over. So that's one element. The other element is racial and ethnic representation, where the Senate is almost exclusively white, and in many ways has gotten worse on this front. A study was done recently that shows that the Senate, that minorities in America, racial and ethnic minorities in America, are less represented in the Senate today than at any time since the end of Reconstruction. The American population has been getting steadily more diverse over the past few decades, while the Senate has really not been getting much more diverse. Or if it has, it's been getting diverse at an extremely slow rate that dramatically lags the diversification of the overall population. So what we have today is this very polarized Senate, where senators toe the party line almost exclusively, and they don't really represent the broader country. So it's not a good situation when you want to have a representative democracy that actually reflects the will of the people.
I think the example you used in your book that really caught my attention was the background checks bill. And the senators who defeated the bill, there were 45 of them, I think you say they represented just 38% of the American people.
That's right. One of the things that you have that this polarization has facilitated is you know, red state senators represent states that tend to have lower populations. This isn't entirely true. You've got Democratic senators from states like Vermont and Rhode Island that have, and New Hampshire, that have small populations. But overall, it is low population, largely rural states that elect Republicans. And so when you look at the percentage of the population that 41 senators represent, and of course, in a Senate where it takes 60 votes to pass anything, 41 senators can block anything they want. You know, the Republican Party can assemble 41 senators to block anything they want, using senators who, you know, the total population they represent adds up to somewhere between 25 and 40% of the American people. And in the case of the background checks bill in 2013, the 45 senators who voted to block that bill represented 38% of the American population. And that, you know, that background checks bill was supported by 90% of the American people. This wasn't a partisan bill. This was something that had near universal support across party lines, Democrats, Republicans, and independents. But senators representing this narrow minority of the population were able to block it because that is the dysfunctional nature of the institution today.
You're listening to Adam Gentleson. He is the author of Kill Switch, The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy. Conservatives love to hearken back to the days of the framers and their thinking, the framers' thinking on the interpretation of the U.S. Constitution, and they're usually looking for original intent. And I suppose in this particular case, they would argue, well, let's face it, the Senate was designed to represent states, not people, so you shouldn't be surprised at a 38% representative group killing a bill. But you have an interesting chapter or two on the framers, Madison in particular, and his take on how our government was to function as far as majority rule is concerned. Maybe you can sum that up for us.
That's right. You know, what conservatives point to is a very real consideration that the framers had for the rights of the minority. The problem with the way conservatives make this argument today is that they dramatically overstate the extent to which the framers wanted to protect the rights of minority factions. The framers wanted minority factions, and I'm talking about numerical minorities here, not racial and ethnic minorities. They wanted minority factions in any given debate, the side that, you know, had less than a majority in their favor, to have a say in the issue. They wanted the Senate to be a place where they could always have time to debate their side, to make their arguments heard, to guarantee that they weren't just steamrolled by the majority, where they could take time and try to persuade people to come over to their side and perhaps, you know, win the argument and win the debate and perhaps, you know, derail the majority by winning more votes than them in the end. But they did not want the minority to be able to block the majority. And they were extremely clear on this point. This is not really up for debate. This isn't really a matter of my interpretation of history. This is very open and shut when you look at what the framers said. In the Federalist Papers, in the notes from the Constitutional Convention, in their personal correspondence, and backed up by their actions, they argued over and over that when the rights of the minority came into conflict with the ability of the majority to rule, that majority rule should take precedence over the rights of the minority. James Madison, who conservatives love to cite because he did write extensively about the need for the protection of numerical minorities, nevertheless said that when these minority rights came into conflict with the ability of a majority to rule in a timely fashion, that majority rule should take precedence. He called majority rule the quote-unquote Republican principle, small r, Republican there. The reason the framers were so fixated on this was that they had just had firsthand experience with what a legislature looks like when a supermajority threshold exists. In the Articles of Confederation, which was sort of the first draft of American government that was in place during the Revolutionary War, its version of Congress had a supermajority threshold in place for most major legislation. It was put there with the idea that, for the reasons filibuster defenders defend it today, with the idea that this would promote compromise and consensus and allow a more thoughtful consideration of major issues. But instead, what happened was that this supermajority threshold in the Continental Congress proved to be a complete disaster, and it proved to do the opposite of creating compromise and consensus. Instead, it manufactured gridlock. And so the framers were coming off this direct firsthand experience with the sort of counterintuitive effect of a supermajority threshold. And they expressed this in the Federalist Papers. In Federalist 22, Alexander Hamilton goes on at great length to say, that you might at first expect a supermajority threshold to create compromising consensus, but in fact it creates gridlock. He writes that what at first sight might seem a remedy is in fact a poison. So they were very aware of the arguments in favor of a supermajority threshold, and they came out very clearly and said that even though you might think that this would promote compromising consensus, what it really does in reality is give the minority the ability to create gridlock. So they were very clear about this. They were very concerned with the rights of the minority, but they made very clear that their top priority was for the government to be able to function. And when those rights of the minority ran up against the need of the majority to rule and to, you know, write and pass laws in a timely fashion, that the ability of the Senate to function and of the government overall to function should take precedence over minority protections.
So we're at this deadlock part of the conversation here, Adam. Let's talk about Rule 22, which was supposedly invented to deal with this. What was its original intent, and how has it been repurposed by obstructionists?
That's right. This is sort of a classic case of unintended consequences here. Rule 22 was introduced in 1917. This is Senate Rule 22. And its purpose, when it was introduced, was to, as the creators of the rule put it, to, quote, terminate successful filibustering. This is the rule that put a supermajority threshold on the books on Senate rules for the first time. So just to underscore that point, you know, all the way from the Senate's founding until 1917, there was no supermajority threshold in the Senate. Everything was majority rule. In 1917, this rule was put in place for the first time that would start to allow people to impose a supermajority threshold, but that wasn't its intent. What it was intended to do was give senators a fallback option for when a filibuster was going on for too long. The idea was that on a procedural vote, senators would be able to come together and agree that whatever filibuster was happening at the time had become unreasonable. And it, you know, this debate on the floor had shifted from the goal of persuasion into outright obstruction. And when that happened, the idea was that a supermajority of senators would be able to come together and cut off that debate so that regardless of where they stood on the issue at hand, they could at least agree that it was time to wrap up this debate and move the issue along to a simple majority vote, which was the norm at the time. What happened, though, was that Southern senators who were self-avowed white supremacists, this is not something they hid, they were very open about white supremacy, they used that term to describe themselves, they faced civil rights bills that had clear prospects of passage. They were passing the House of Representatives in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s by wide margins. They had majority support in the Senate, and they had broad public support, as well as presidents of both parties willing to sign them. So what Southern senators around this time started to do was they repurposed Rule 22 and started to turn it into a de facto supermajority threshold for passage, but only for civil rights bills. The way they did this was they would launch a talking filibuster, this filibuster that your listeners might be familiar with from movies like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, of, you know, a senator actually standing on the floor for a long time, holding the floor, you know, debating at length to block the passage or progress of a bill. What the Southern senators would do, they, as a block, they represented about 20 or so seats, depending on the year, and they could coordinate with each other. So instead of having just one senator talk for a long time, you know, they would coordinate amongst themselves and be able to really stall a bill indefinitely, because by passing the baton back and forth among the 20 or so members of this block, they could keep it going indefinitely. So by doing that, you know, the only issue that motivated them to launch these coordinated filibusters, which really took a lot of time and effort to launch, was civil rights. It was the only issue that motivated anybody to launch such coordinated filibusters. And once they had these coordinated filibusters going, the only way the majority could cut it off was by invoking the supermajority threshold. Now, on most other issues, that wouldn't have been so hard, but Southern senators were extraordinarily powerful. This was a time before there were majority and minority leaders. Those positions weren't invented until the 1920s. And even after they were invented, they were basically clerical positions that didn't have a lot of power. So the Southern senators were the power center of the Senate. They controlled most of the major committees. They had monopoly control of the most important committees. They had basically lifelong appointments in their states because their states were deeply Democratic. They were Democrats at the time. And so if you cross these Southern senators, it was a very bad career move to do so. So they would be able to launch these talking filibusters, and then they would say to their opponents, I dare you to invoke the supermajority threshold. And if you do, it's going to be a bad career move. I will use my power as a Southern senator to block you from committee assignments and scuttle all the legislation that you care about. So this was the state of play all the way through the 1960s and 70s, where the only bills that faced anything resembling a supermajority threshold were civil rights bills. And it was this sort of de facto repurposing of Rule 22 that twisted it away from its original intent, which was to cut off filibusters, and started to turn it into a de facto supermajority threshold for passage, but only of civil rights legislation. And just to underscore that, all of the legislation that continued to pass during this time, all of the New Deal legislation, all of the Great Society legislation, aside from civil rights, did not encounter filibusters. None of that legislation that built post-war America ever had to clear a supermajority threshold. It all continued to pass on a simple majority basis.
I'm Bob Custer here at Reader's Corner. I'm interviewing Adam Gentleson, who's the author of Kill Switch, The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy. So that vision we all have are these senators on the floor, maybe only one, talking for hours, doing everything like reading a telephone book or whatever will pass the time to keep this bill from coming to a vote. Well, that's certainly changed. Now we have a silent version of the filibuster. How did that happen? And tell us how that works.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, the filibuster, whenever you see senators on the floor today, you know, if they're pretending to wage a filibuster, you know, Ted Cruz recently did this when we read Green Eggs and Ham. They're basically faking it. It's not really how the filibuster works anymore. They may be doing it for dramatic effect or to try to create a viral moment. You know, what's happened today is that the filibuster has shifted and, in fact, become more powerful because of this shift. Rather than having to hold the floor, what senators can do today is simply signal their intent to filibuster, which they can do simply by sending an email to their leadership in what's called the cloakroom, which is sort of the room just off the Senate floor where each side has one. And, you know, from those rooms, all the action on the floor is run. They send an email signaling their intent to filibuster. And what that does is it automatically raises the threshold for passage on a bill, in effect, to a supermajority threshold. An irony of this whole thing is that the rules on the books today still state that for passage of a bill, it only takes a majority. The reason we accept this idea that it takes a supermajority is that this intermediate step of having to end debate is what takes a supermajority. And so the act of sending that email and signaling your intent to filibuster throws up this procedural hurdle that makes it impossible for most bills to clear. And you don't have to hold the floor to do that. All you have to do is say, I reserve my right to continue debating this bill. You know, another irony of this is that it's that right to debate that senators are invoking when they throw up this supermajority threshold. They are saying that I'm invoking my right as a member of the Senate to debate this bill indefinitely. And when you do that, you invoke Rule 22, which we just discussed, which requires a supermajority of senators to bring debate to a close. But you don't actually have to go to the floor to debate it. You just have to send an email invoking that right, and that's what throws up the procedural hurdle. So, you know, senators don't have to appear on the floor. They don't have to even make a public statement expressing why they're opposing a bill. They just have to send an email or make a comment in passing to a member of their leadership staff that they intend to filibuster this bill. And all of a sudden, instead of taking a majority to pass a bill, it goes up to a supermajority because this procedural hurdle has been thrown up.
Well, Adam, it's not only the type of filibuster that has changed in the U.S. Senate, but it's the volume of filibusters. And I wonder if you could share with us Mitch McConnell's early years, I think, during the Obama administration. How many filibusters in two short years are we talking about here?
Yes, that's right. So, you know, this period that I just described of you know, the evolution of the supermajority threshold, this took place in the 70s, 80s, and 90s when bills started to become filibustered and encounter the supermajority threshold. You know, more commonly, but we were still talking during this period, you know, maybe a few dozen or two-year terms of the Senate. The Senate works in two-year sessions. So, you know, up until Mitch McConnell became minority leader, you were looking at, you know, somewhere in the sort of 40s to 60 range of filibusters per 2 years. When McConnell became minority leader, that number immediately doubled to over 120. He became minority leader in 2007. When Obama came into office in 2008, the number continued to rise into the 250s. So what we're talking about is an escalation of an entirely different magnitude than anything the Senate had ever seen before. What McConnell did that no other leader had done was make a strategic calculation that the filibuster could be used to apply the supermajority 60-vote threshold to everything the Senate did, not just to major bills or legislation, not just to big-ticket items or nominations, but to simply every piece of business before the Senate. And his calculation was that this would impose a level of gridlock that would make everything Washington did look ugly, look slow, and look inefficient. And he was doing this under a president, President Obama, who had come into office promising to fix the broken politics in Washington. So, you know, the sort of strategic cleverness of McConnell's calculation was that even if he couldn't beat Obama on several of his most important agenda items, and it's important to remember that when Obama came into office, he had huge majorities in the House of Representatives and the Senate. Democrats controlled 60 seats in the Senate, depending on the month. There were a few party switches in there with Arlen Specter and a late election in Minnesota. But, you know, for several months in 2009, Democrats had 60 votes in the Senate. So McConnell's bet was that even when if he couldn't beat Obama on some of his big ticket legislative items, he could make everything slow and everything ugly by applying this supermajority threshold as a weapon of mass obstruction. And whether you agree with McConnell's intent or not, from a purely political perspective, he succeeded. Even though Obama notched some major wins in 2009 and 2010, McConnell made everything look slow and ugly, and Republicans were massively rewarded in the 2010 midterms. They won 63 seats in the House and 7 seats in the Senate. You know, we look back at 2018 and think there was this big blue wave and Democrats did really well. Well, they won 40 seats in the House. That's very good. But in 2010, Republicans won 63 seats in the House. So this strategy of mass obstruction paid off for Republicans. And, you know, part of what we're seeing today is that Republicans simply have no political incentive to work together. Obstruction works. You know, this is exactly what the framers predicted. They said if you put this supermajority threshold in place, you're going to create an irresistible political temptation for the party that's out of power to obstruct and delay and try to make the administration look bad. In Federalist 22, Alexander Hamilton said that what the majority would try to do was to embarrass the administration. These are very prophetic words, and that's exactly what we're seeing today.
You have an excellent concluding chapter, which is a list of recommendations on how to save the Senate. And one of them is democratizing Senate leadership. And I'd like you to comment on that in terms of an earlier chapter of yours where you argue that Democrat leadership may have created these leadership structures that have members marching in lockstep behind a leader's agenda, and that may have, in fact, paved the way for a guy like McConnell.
That's right. You know, I mean, I'm a Democrat. I worked for Democrats. I worked for Harry Reid. I certainly don't make any attempt to hide my own party affiliation and ideological preferences. But certainly, Democrats, you know, have helped lead the Senate astray in important ways, too. And my former boss, you know, Harry Reid, helped create these top-down leadership structures that I think are part of what is wrong with the Senate today. You know, what I described earlier about the scene you would see on C-SPAN of senators sort of speaking to an empty chamber. A big reason why that is because senators spend most of their time in the Senate awaiting their marching orders from leadership. And so what I would like to see is to have these top-down leadership structures democratized. And these structures are enforced through a range of basically a set of informal arrangements and power structures. There's no formal Senate rule giving the leader power. You know, the Speaker of the House, by contrast, is a position that's created by the Constitution and has always existed and has enormous power by its control of the Rules Committee in the House. Whereas in the Senate, as I mentioned earlier, the position of majority and minority leader didn't even exist until the 1920s. The Senate was supposed to be a leaderless institution. Members were all supposed to be able to wield equal power and decide the direction of the Senate based on a given day. And if you worked on a piece of legislation as a rank and file member of the Senate, you were supposed to be able to get a vote for it if you were able to find support and, you know, get it to the floor. So that's what I would like to see the Senate go back to. And that means taking away some of the tools that leaders use to exert this control. These are informal tools. They could be done without major reforms to the Senate. There are tools like what's called filling the tree, which is a method that's used to block all other amendments from coming to the floor, except for the ones that the leader wants to come to the floor. I'd like to see those means of control weakened so that what you could have is a Senate where there was the possibility of free and open debate, where a senator who worked on an issue could get a vote on their amendment without necessarily having to have the approval of the leader. I think that that sort of open type of forum would be a good thing for democracy, and it would be a good thing for the development and cross-pollination of ideas across party lines.
Well, my last question, Adam, may be the toughest to answer. What's the prospects for this list of recommendations actually becoming a reality, especially the one about restoring majority rule?
Well, I would say that, you know, you have this interesting dynamic where you've got, you know, probably about 48 votes for a lot of these reforms in the Senate. And you only need 50. An important thing to note here is that because the Senate was designed as a majority rule institution, the ability of the majority to change the rules trumps every other rule. So even though these structures have grown up over recent decades that create a de facto supermajority threshold, any rule can be changed at any time by a majority vote. So, you know, on the Democratic side, you've got about 48 senators who've expressed openness to reform. And then you've got two senators who are very firmly planted against reform in Manchin and Sinema. I think the idea of returning to a full majority rule Senate is unlikely given the opposition of Manchin and Sinema, at least in the immediate term. However, you know, even Manchin has expressed openness to some very significant reforms to the filibuster in the past. For instance, you know, this supermajority threshold I'm talking about, there are two opportunities to do that on a bill, once on the front end and once on the back end. So, you know, as we saw recently with the debate over voting rights, you can filibuster that bill from even coming to the floor and being debated. Manchin in the past has expressed openness to getting rid of that filibuster on the front end. So I think the prospect of more modest reforms like that are still very real. I also think, you know, there's a piece written recently in the Washington Post that said the filibuster is on the ballot in 2022. Depending on what happens in 2022, if Democrats could gain one or two more seats so that Manchin and Sinema were not the deciding votes, then I think the filibuster will definitely be gone. But the bottom line to me is that, as I lay out in the book, this is an effort that's been going on for over 200 years. You know, ever since John Calhoun launched one of the first filibusters in the 1840s, and Henry Clay, the great compromiser, saw what was happening, Henry Clay launched an effort to reform the filibuster. So this is something that's been happening for a very long time. And I think we are extremely close now, closer than we've ever been, to having major reforms. So while those last two votes are going to be the hardest to get, we've come an extremely long way. And I think the prospects for reform are very real in the near term, you know, perhaps more modest reforms. But if Democrats can survive 2022 and gain a seat or two, I think then getting rid of the filibuster altogether is a very real possibility.
Well, I can't think of any book that we've read here at Reader's Corner that is as timely as yours. I mean, you dropped this book just at the moment that this was front page headlines across every newspaper in America and every TV show conversation. So again, excellent job. And I can't encourage our listeners more to get out there and get a copy of Kill Switch: The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy by Adam Gentleson. Adam, thanks for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thanks so much for having me, Bob. It was a real pleasure.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News, and these weekly interviews are also available on the Reader's Corner podcast. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.